Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to Past Imperfect. I'm Alice Thompson.
And I'm Rachel Sylvester. And in this show, we talk to extraordinary people who have overcome trauma or adversity in their early lives to achieve great success.
Our guest today is one of this country's most successful businessmen, who made his millions in the city before turning to philanthropy and the arts, and was once named as the most powerful black man in Britain.
Sir Damon Buffini was a founding partner of Europe's largest private equity company, Permira. Over almost 3 decades, it turned into a £20 billion empire that had amassed brands including Hugo Boss, Travelodge and the AA.
Since leaving Permira in 2015, he's become chairman of the National Theatre, the Royal Anniversary Trust, which awards the Queen's Prize for Education, and the Ryder Cup Committee for the European Golf Tour.
He was appointed by Boris Johnson to run the £1.6 billion Culture Recovery Fund, which was set up to distribute grants for theatres, galleries and museums to try and help them survive the pandemic.
He may be on the UK rich list, but his rags-to-riches stories that began on a council estate in Leicester means he has never taken anything for granted. Once, when he heard his colleagues complaining about the food in a 5-star hotel, he asked the Michelin-starred kitchen to prepare burgers the following night. And as the ungrateful partners tucked in, he told them they didn't know how lucky they were.
So Damon, I think I'm right in saying you've only ever done one media interview, and that was 14 years ago. So thank you very much for being a guest on Past
Pleasure.
Perfect.
So you're chairman of the National Theatre and the Ryder Cup, which is an amazing combination. But do you feel more at home on the golf course or in a theatre?
Well, both. It depends on, you know, depends on the time of day. And at the moment, of course, theatres are really closed, so there's no opportunity to actually go to the theatre at all, which is
What's
a real
handicap?
Shame. 11, sometimes. If I'm playing well, it can really vary quite a lot, unfortunately. But, you know, it's room for improvement.
You must have spent most of your time recently on the Cultural Recovery Board. How worried are you about theatres? Do you think that some are going to just go under, not survive?
Performing arts is so important for this country, not just in terms of entertainment, but just in terms of soft power. The economics that it brings to the country, but also community spirit, but just the projection of what we're really excellent at, that's performing arts for the UK. And it's been closed, literally closed. The National Theatre has been closed since March, and most other performing arts organisations have been completely closed. So that is very worrying. Now, I think that the Culture Recovery Fund, the £1.6 billion Culture Recovery Fund that was set up in July, is a real lifeline. I mean, it's provided support to something like 3,000 organisations. About 70,000 jobs supported directly. That supported buildings, but it hasn't been able to support the freelancers, which is troubling. But hopefully, given the innovation of the arts and, you know, the determination of the people in it that I know, they'll be back. And hopefully the Culture Recovery Fund will make sure that when the pandemic passes, which it will, you know, this really important sector for the country will survive and prosper.
And do you think that applies to the economy in general as well? How quickly do you think things are going to bounce back?
There's always a recovery. Like the 2007-2008 financial crisis, when we were in that, it was desperate and very difficult and a dark time, but there was a recovery. There will be a recovery from this, but this, you've got a combination of economic downturn and a health crisis. I haven't really seen that before, not in anyone's living memory. So how the recovery will come about, what change there will be, there will definitely be some permanent changes. You know, travel, working from home, as we say, working in cities. So we'll have to see how that pans out.
We wanted to go back to your childhood and the life you led, which must now feel worlds away, really, from where you were born. You grew up in Leicester. Can you describe what your first home was like?
I grew up on a council estate in Leicester called Thurnby Lodge. which Leicester is ringed by council estates. So they were, a lot of them were built in the late 40s, early 50s. And Thurnby Lodge was a classic council estate. So it had, you know, the Mayflower pub, had the fish and chip shop, had, you know, the green where we play football on the street because there were no cars. Our house is pretty small, very cold. But the interesting thing about our estate, which I quite often reflect on, it was pretty much 100% white. So, I mean, I grew up in a really white environment. So my mother's white, my grandparents are white, my grandfather's Irish, my grandmother's from Yorkshire, and the whole estate was pretty much like that until Idi Amin ejected the Asians in the early 70s. It was, there were very few people of colour on our estate. I think I was probably the only one.
So did you feel very different?
Well, I was different. Mm. You know, and that's one abiding memory. But the other abiding memory is I used to go to school on the bus and everybody was going to work in Leicester. But the work ethic was pretty incredible. Going to the factories, the shoe factories, the hosiery factories, whatever, textile factories. That's what I remember. So do I remember being different? Yeah, but that I don't. That's my abiding memory of Leicester at that time and that council estate.
And was money very tight? I mean, was it difficult for your mother to balance the books? Did she find it hard?
Yeah, so my mother worked two jobs continuously when we were growing up. We were never short of food. The school uniform was always clean. We had to hang it up when we came home from school, and that still drives me mad because my kids don't do that. We had a support network. So my grandparents were just around the corner, and so they helped out. So when we used to come back from school, you know, they'd make a jam sandwich, and off we'd go and play. And sometimes my grandfather's eyesight wasn't very good, so sometimes we got an instant coffee sandwich, wasn't so great. But that support network was always there.
Do you think your mother made sacrifices for you?
Oh yeah, working two jobs is quite hard, right? So go to work at the gas boiler in the day and go and work at the Grand Hotel in the evening. That's pretty tough, yeah. You know, and to do that continuously.
Was it difficult for her being a single mother, do you think? Because at the time, you know, there was so much backlash against single mothers that continued really until the sort of 90s, didn't it? That sense that you couldn't be born out of wedlock, whereas now that seems ridiculous. Then it was quite prevalent, wasn't it, that idea that you had to have two parents with you?
Yeah, so my mother met my father, who was a serviceman, in the late 50s. So there were a few service bases near Leicester, at Alconbury and Lakenheath, I think. And my mum met my father there, and it was quite vibrant. It was probably quite exciting. Right, and they got together, but my father had to go back to America in about 63, something like that, and my mother just decided not to go. And in hindsight, it was the right decision. You know, if you remember, in the 60s in America, in lots of states it was illegal to be a mixed-race couple, right? Illegal. So in Leicester, having a mixed-race child was, you know, unusual, but in America it was completely unacceptable. So my mother, quite right in hindsight, decided not to go back. That's tough. That's a tough call, right? So bringing you know, us up, me up, and my sister up on our own with my grandparents' support was a big decision, but it's definitely the right decision. Going back to America, it would have been really difficult.
Have you ever tried to find your father?
No, he's never really part of my life.
Okay.
Right, so I grew up without him.
So you never met him?
Never met him. Not really interested. It was just a situation that I was in.
And you've never had any genetic tests, so you don't know?
No genetic tests.
Other relatives in America?
No. We, interesting, the company that does the genetic test, Ancestry.com, we invested in when I was at Pamira. So I'm delighted to see they're doing so well. But no, we haven't. And because it was just the situation that we were in, we just got on with it. Mm. And, you know, we were a single parent family, and that's how we grew up. And it didn't really affect me much. I think it probably made me more independent from early age. So you've got to get yourself to football. You've got to do the laundry. You've got to cook some of the meals. You've got to make sure the fire works and fill the coal scuttle. I mean, it sounds a bit Victorian, but that's what you have
your
to do.
Your mum must have been an incredibly powerful influence on you then. What was she like? Did she really push you on? Was she very ambitious for you?
Yeah, she is. Still, you know, quite feisty, very gregarious. Didn't finish her education. She's very bright, but she didn't really finish it. And I think that was a frustration for her. My grandparents also, you know, they were in service. They'd been in service all their lives. And they could see, both my mum and my grandparents could see, you know, the power of education. You know, if you wanted to be a, you know, respected professional, a doctor or a lawyer or something like that, you had to be educated. Right? And that's why they were so keen for that to happen. And I think when I passed the 11 plus, they were more relieved than anything else. They thought, okay, you're on the journey now. But they understood the power of education, and that's, I think, that was really instilled in me.
What did your grandparents do?
My grandfather worked for the Guinness family, and then my grandmother was also the lead cook at the Leicester, one of the Leicester sort of clubs, men's clubs, or whatever it's called. I don't know what it was, but she was a very good cook. Great apple pie and great apple crumble.
So again, enormous work ethic.
Yeah. Yeah, they were. My grandfather's working too. He was like 78. Right.
Did you get a prize for having got the 11 plus and got into your school? You remember the day?
No prize. More relief, as I said. At the time, you don't realise when you're taking it how life-changing that is. Certainly at that time, definitely was. And it's a very early age, so that's a real moment in someone's life early on for you know, the two pathways to diverge. Then I went to Gateway Grammar School. Leicester, I don't know whether they did it officially, but they certainly did it informally, socially selected grammar schools. So if you were, you know, from a professional class, you went to one grammar school, but if you were from the council estate, all the council estate boys, because it was single, all went to Gateway Grammar School. So you can imagine how uncontrollable that was. So we, remember, we set the relief teacher's blazer on fire with a Bunsen burner, and our school was really dilapidated, so we had prefabs on the roof from, I think probably from the war anyway. One of the boys got expelled for setting some fireworks off on the top there. I mean, it just, you know, really bright, but quite disruptive. And by the time they were 14 or 15, they, you know, lots of them had stopped working. They just didn't want to do it anymore. And I could have been one of those quite easily. You know, I was quite sort of confident, probably overconfident, a bit cheeky. But at some stage, I might have slightly gone over the line. I got put on something called school report, where you had to sort of fill in your behaviour sheet every lesson and stand outside the headmaster's office every break. Oh, God, it was so embarrassing. It was really embarrassing. I thought, I can't be doing this. I've got to get a grip of myself. And from that moment, I really changed my attitude and started to work quite hard. But I was never the top of the class.
Do you think because your father wasn't there, you had a sense of responsibility to your mum that it drove you on? It made you feel you had to achieve, almost to make up for his absence?
No, that never crossed my mind at all. There's some things in our, there's a phrase in our family which says, don't rest on your laurels. I think might be a Yorkshire phrase. My grandma's called Alice Maud Mary Silverside, so she's definitely from Yorkshire. Mm-hmm. And that, what that means, I think, is, you know, don't be complacent, keep moving forward. And I think that's what really drove me on. It's nothing to do with my father not being there, or it's just, as I said, pretty irrelevant. But it was certainly something in me which said, look, if you want to get out of here, then you've got to rely on yourself to do it.
So where does that come from, though?
I think it's in some people, it's in them.
We talk a lot now, though, about boys needing fathers and how difficult it is that they don't, and why it's caused such complications. Do you think that can be alleviated by having very strong grandparents or parents or family systems?
Mm. As a father, I'd like to think that, you know, boys do need their fathers. But I've also seen that sometimes families are better off without some fathers. And there's no doubt that other family structures, support networks, you know, it can be just as good, if not better. Right? And we had incredible support from, you know, from my aunts and from my uncles, and, you know, that made a difference to us. And there's a lot of research on role models and providing aspiration, but certainly in my instance, that support network was really, really, really helped me.
Do you think actually having working parents is more important, maybe, that sense of a work ethic that you learn from a family rather than
certainly seeing people at work is important, but it's also seeing people that are educated, seeing people that have got on in life, role models. There's lots of factors, I think, that it's very complicated, this what drives this socioeconomic changes, social mobility. There are lots of factors. But certainly, from my point of view, having that support network that was there that I could go to if I needed it, it's very powerful for me.
Did you ever experience racism? If you were the only mixed-race boy in your estate and in your school?
This is the 1970s. Mm. So by the time I was 10, I'd probably encountered every single racial slur that you could ever imagine. Primetime TV was Love Thy Neighbour. And that was primetime TV based on racial tension and offensive language, right? So that just got played back all the time. When it's in your face, right, which it is all the time, it's quite easy to deal with. Because, right? You can see where it's coming from, you can react, you can take it on. And my peer group, I was playing football with them, it just sort of went away. Most of the racially offensive stuff was from older people, really. I was playing football once, and I'm on the sideline taking a throw in, and the coach, so a grown man, came up to me and said, it must be a bit cold for you here, son. And there was nobody there, literally. Didn't seem anybody. There was one man and his dog, and I'm running along, and this banana was thrown onto the pitch. If you remember, John Barnes was getting that all the time, so that happened. So, yeah,
do you think that made you more resilient, that you're all determined to prove the racist wrong?
At that time, it was par for the course, right? That's what you grew up with. There's lots of things that drive you on, your economic circumstances, the fact that you believe that you're different and maybe you're an outsider, but that sort of behaviour, you just got on with it.
So what do you think made you want to work so hard, and why did you want to achieve academically?
Well, I was never the brightest at school. I was never top of the class. For me, it was 10% inspiration and 9% application, perspiration. So it was all more hard work than anything else. But it became obvious that if you were going to do something with your life, you had to. Education was the pathway. And as I said, my mother, my grandparents, none of them went to university. But they could really see the power of that.
And why did you want to go to Cambridge? Did you see pictures of it? Had you been
no,
there?
No, no. I decided I wanted to be a lawyer. So I said to my aunt, who was about 14, I said, I want to go and do some soliciting. and she said, I don't think you really mean that. But I wanted to be a lawyer because they were respected in the community, and that was important. My grandparents thought that was really important. But Cambridge was never on the rise at all. One or two people had gone to Cambridge from my school. I'd never been to Cambridge. But when I did well in my A-levels, really well, they said, well, why don't you apply? So I went and had an interview. And I met this great character called Dr. Peter Linehan, who was Dumbledore before Harry Potter. Right? Unfortunately, he passed away last year, but the last time I saw him, he was wearing a cloak. He's great. And he interviewed me. I think he could just see that academically I was probably bright enough, sociable, sporty, and he just thought, okay, you'll fit the bill, you'll do well here. I think the criteria might have changed somewhat in Cambridge now. But at that time, that really did fit the bill, and he really took me under his wing, and I passed the interview and got in, and I'd only been there once. I went for the interview.
So what was it like when you arrived?
Oh, it's like the moon. It's beautiful, right? I mean, it's an absolutely stunning place.
And did you have to wear gowns and have formal dresses?
Only once or twice. It's not like Hogwarts, but it is 15th, 16th century, new court, third court, incredible.
Did you love it, or was it intimidating?
The work was fine. Social life was great. I made some great friends for life, and I still have them. But it was actually, it was probably the only place before or since where I came across really unpleasant racism.
Really? Right? Yeah. In what form?
Well, for the first couple of years, it was fine. Right, I got on everybody. And then in the third year, just a group of my peers who I thought I knew just decided that they'd make my life misery. And they excluded me from sports societies, cocktail parties, all everything. And it was really, we were talking about, it's really insidious. You couldn't really find out why they were doing it. I think one of my friends said, the reason why they're doing it is because they don't think you're a real gentleman.
No.
Can you imagine?
And were they all public school-y types?
Yeah, and...
Was that racial, do you think, or was it social? What do you think was driving it?
Well...
Was it impossible to say?
Impossible to say, but I would say definitely it's a combination of both.
Mm. Have you come across anything again?
Mm. Now and again.
Did you confront them about it?
But it's very hard to do that.
Yeah.
We're sort of on your own. I mean, there were at Cambridge at the time, really the only other black people. There might have been a few, but most of them were African princes. Right? So not many from my background. So very hard to call it out. And that's why when it's in your face, it's a lot easier to deal with. When it's like that, it's very hard. Mm. Which is
why
institutions...
How did you pick yourself up then? Because it's very... I mean, it must be really difficult right at the end when you thought you'd made all your friends.
What's the choice?
Yeah.
What's the choice? So move on and just think, if you're ever in a position of influence, something like that, just make sure that doesn't happen. Which is why it's so important now for these institutions to really be close to what's going on in them. And I think Cambridge, is much better now. They have a lot of outreach programs. They're spending a lot of money on trying to reach that cohort of young people, whether it's white working class or people of colour, to try and get them in. So the mindset is completely different now, and lots of programmes. But there's more to do. I mean, I know they accept that. The current Vice Chancellor, it's nearly top of his agenda to do something about this. But I think it's a different place now. They really understand that trying to broaden out the intake is important for them.
But what do they need to do more? What do you think? Do you think they just...
Well, I think one of the real issues that you have is that lots of the people they're trying to attract just don't think it's for them.
Mm.
Right? When I said they do think it's the moon, right? They think it's full of public school people. They think it's too much like hard work. They won't meet anyone like them there. It's just not for them. So you have to get it over to them that it is... they will enjoy it. It is for them. It'll really help them in their, in their career. So that's the point of this outreach, just to persuade them to apply.
Mm. Was it a game changer for you that being able to say that you'd been to Oxbridge? Did that open doors in a way that you think
Cambridge.
You wouldn't have done? Sorry,
Cambridge.
Oxbridge. Yes, Cambridge. Cambridge. You always say Cambridge.
You don't like
the Oxbridge.
Cambridge. It sort of was. Although I did law and I really didn't like it. It wasn't for me. So I left Cambridge without a job. I could have gone and worked for a law firm. I just thought, no, I'd do this all. I'm not going to be very successful. So I left without a job. But then I'm sure it was helpful. I found a small consulting firm called the LEK Partnership. It was three partners who worked for Bain who left Bain and set up on their own. And it was a really entrepreneurial, vibrant, small, I was employee number nine. We were in a basement in St. James's Square place. I'm sure the fact that I went to Cambridge got me in the door, but it was great. And then one day one of the partners, Ian Evans, who I subsequently got to know very well, said, "Look, if you can get into Harvard Business School, we'll pay for you to go. We'll pay half of it." So I said, "Great." So I left his office and I said, "Well, I wonder what Harvard Business School is." No idea. And I thought, okay, this looks quite interesting. So I applied and I got in, and they paid for half.
How did that compare to Cambridge?
It was much more expensive. That's for sure.
You're listening to Past Imperfect with Rachel Sylvester and Alice Thompson and our guest, Damon Biffini. There'll be more from us after this.
celebrate the beginning of spring, save 50% on full digital access to The Times and The Sunday Times for 6 months and stay well informed on the latest stories. Visit thetimes.co.uk/sale/past-imperfect and subscribe today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome back to Past Imperfect, with our guest this week, Damon Buffini, the businessman, chair of the National Theatre and Culture Recovery Fund.
Is it true you doorstepped one of the executives and wouldn't let him into a party until he gave you a job?
I think it was Black Monday, 1987, and the weather was terrible. So I was 5 minutes early for this sort of milk round type interview, and Nick Ferguson and Sir Wim Bischoff, who ran shows at the time, they were both there. So I had 15 minutes. Everybody else was 10 minutes late. So I had 15 minutes on my own with the two of them.
So just because you were punctual, basically.
Yeah, I was early.
and did you say to them?
I remember. I'd sort of said, look, I'm very interested in what you do and I'd love to come and have an interview and, you know, the normal sort of stuff. And had a chat about the weather, probably. And it was Black Monday, so the stock market had gone down hugely. So we talked about that. And then when Sir Wim said, look, come and have some interviews in London. Now, if you remember back then, 1984, the city was completely closed to people like me. I mean, that was really old school Thai. I think I'd lost my school Thai, so there's no chance. No chance. And it really took posh and closed. But then it was right on the cusp of Big Bang. So by the time I was, 88 came back, when I came around, when I was leaving Harvard Business School, it was still pretty blue blood, but there were other things were starting to happen. You know, it's a bit more entrepreneurial. So I went to had interviews at the Merchant Bank, and eventually somebody said, well, you know, Damon, I really think that although we like you at the Merchant Bank, I really think that Schroeder Ventures is much better for you. What they really meant was that's where we're putting all the sort of oiks and the entrepreneurs and go and work there. But it was right. It was totally different.
And did you have to push much harder because you weren't part of the establishment, do you think? I mean, did you look at it and were you allowed to, in a way, be more pushy because you were an outsider?
Push is a really strange word, isn't it? I mean, when you come from a certain sort of background, you know, the opportunities don't present themselves very, very often. Right? So when they do, you've got to take them. Right? You really do. And, you know, there's no gap year, there's no retakes. There's none of that. Right? So there's no safety net. So take the opportunities. And the work ethic is quite high, and the determination numbers as well. You know, don't take no for an answer. So I think, and if you're part of the establishment, whatever that means, you look at that and you think, well, that's really pushy, isn't it? And that's maybe quite aggressive. But it's not. It's just where you come from and how you've got to where you've got to. So when by the time they see you, that's probably an inbuilt characteristic that you then take on. And lots of outsiders have got that.
So actually, being outside almost makes you better at your job.
It can certainly give you that energy and determination to really drive forward.
Yeah. Did you also get that in America? Because I remember there's that sense, when I was there exactly the same after university, that there's a far more energetic entrepreneurial spirit that was in America then in the 80s and the 90s than really was in Britain at the time.
I mean, even the word entrepreneur probably wasn't common parlance in the UK when I went to Harvard Business School. There were classes of on it at Harvard Business School. So entrepreneurialism, being able to create a business and for yourself, just, you know, I spent a lot of my summers working for the gas board. Right? These big sort of conglomerates, these big businesses, but actually be going to be able to start your own business and grow your own business. Fantastic. Let's go and do that. So a lot of energy, a lot of drive, and you know, it comes from America. So yes, and that really opens your eyes as to what is achievable. Right? It really does. Really,
so is it more about making money, your decision to go into the city, or is it about the challenge and the sort of innovation of the thing?
So I joined Schroeder Ventures, became Premier in 1988. And at that time, it was a very small, nascent industry. No one really heard of it. And I thought, well, I liked the people. I liked the what they were doing. Very entrepreneurial, a lot of energy. Very different organisation. So 30% of the partners were women in the late 80s.
Which then would have been really unusual.
Very unusual. And I could have gone and worked for an investment bank, or could have gone and worked for a law firm and earned a lot more money. But I really thought that I'd do well in that environment. I just enjoyed what they were doing, and I thought that would be quite exciting to do. And it was. We were just a group of very young people. Most of us were there for nearly 30 years. But we all started at the same time. And we're doing some really innovative, small, risky investment, you know, making some mistakes. And it was very entrepreneurial. So we met entrepreneurs. We met some that were great and some of them were not. And we made some mistakes and you learn on the way. And we were all very young and we used to get a lot of, it was venture capital, so we used to get a lot of people that came in and really wasted our time. You know, perpetual engines and all this sort of stuff. So eventually we all sat around the table and said, look, the next one who comes in, that's it. And we, just show them the door. So anyway, so one of my partners saw that literally. So he went in, this guy came in and gave him his idea. And we, the partner said, look, just my advice to you is just don't give up your day job. So with that, James Dyson took his vacuum cleaner and left our office. Yeah.
And there was one moment where the partners started to take themselves a bit too seriously and they were complaining about the food in the 5-star hotel. Is that what happened? Why did you decide to challenge that?
By that time, we were successful. So this was in the 2008, something like that. And the culture of our firm, we called ourselves, we all worked together for a long time, as I said, and when we bought the business from Schroeder's, surprisingly, well, not surprisingly, the Schroeder's family wouldn't sell us their name. So we had to choose a new name. So we chose Pamira, which means surprising and different. And the reason for that is we thought we built a very good business, which was a real meritocracy, a culture where we put our clients first, try to respect everybody we work with. And that was really important to us. And that's why we chose the name, because we thought that was different. You know, it's already all well and good saying you've got a strong culture, but you've got to live it. And we were celebrating raising one of our funds. So we had all of the partners and all the non-partners at the dinner in a big hotel. And we were there for 2 nights. And the first night, it was great. It was a great menu, really good food. And I think the next morning I think it was a partner, but just complained about the food, just wanted something different, and was a bit rude to somebody who was serving the food. And peer pressure is a fantastic thing, right? So I just stood up and said, look, you all thought you were going to have a 5-star meal this evening, but you're not. There's going to be no choice. This is what it's going to be. It's going to be hamburgers and chips. They're pretty nice hamburgers, but that's what it's going to be. No choice. And the reason for that is because of what happened last night. And it's just not acceptable. I mean, lots of people think they can manage upwards and they don't, they don't bother about the people that they work with, their peer group or whatever. And that's not the culture we wanted to enforce. And that's why I did that.
And do you think that sort of the atmosphere then was out of control in some ways, that before the first really recession in 2008?
The city is an interesting place. One says, well, it's really aggressive and cutthroat. But it's not like that. I mean, when you're in business for 27 years, you're dealing with the same people time and time again. You're not going to be in business for long if you don't treat them with respect. Now, there's always a bit of euphoria, and there's always a little bit of some people just don't get it and don't behave in the way that you want, that you think they should behave. You know, respecting everybody you deal with, and it doesn't matter what they are or where they are, and you just have to. You have to call that out.
Do you think that's partly because of your background, that you just always had your feet on the ground? You knew that you just shouldn't get out of control. You should take things, you should respect other people and also be grateful for what you've got and you've earned.
Well, it's important, isn't it? So I think we knew the definition of hubris, and we, every single office knew that, what it was in their own language. It happens quite often. Right? You see lots of businesses that do well, they grow, and for one reason or another, can't keep it going. And that was more important for us. Mm. But just the culture that we were trying to create, and I believe we did create, with a real partnership that everybody contributes, and it's a meritocracy. That was just so important for us.
And did you always feel like an outsider in the city, or did you feel, because you were so, you got right to the top, but was there always something in you that felt that you weren't or going to fit in to that sort of established view?
Yeah, so I was always a bit of an outsider, right? So there's no golf club and tennis club when I was growing up. And, you know, as I said, at Cambridge, I was sort of meant to feel a bit like as an outsider sometimes. In the city, or in financial services, or really the upper echelons of any organisations, it's very unusual to see people of colour, right? It really still is unusual. And that was definitely true in the 90s. So when I walked in as a managing partner of Permira, imagine a few eyebrows were raised, and we had offices all around the world there. And we were thinking about opening South Africa, so you can imagine how that went down. You know, managing partners coming and it's me. It was unusual for me.
So what do you feel about the Black Lives Matter campaign? Which, do you feel it got wrapped up in a sort of wider left-wing anti-capitalist politics?
So BLM clearly overtly came out of hideous images, and what happened was terrible. But I think it's a reflection of the sort of slow progress of civil rights in its broadest sense. And I can identify with that. You know, there's a lot of talk, but some action, but poor results. So I can understand that. Now, having lived in both countries, America is totally different to the UK. This race issue in America is ingrained, it's vicious, and it's violent. I mean, when I was there, and my now wife was working as a lawyer, and I went to see her with one of my white friends, and the receptionist just looked at me and him and said, "Hello, sir, how can I help you?" and turned to me and went, "The mail room is on the right."
No.
Yeah, and chased by people with baseball bats with violent intentions. Mm. That, it's different here. We've got our issues, right? We've got our issues, Windrush, stop and search. We've got all sorts of issues. Mm. But this country is much more it's multicultural. There's something in our makeup that is multicultural. So we BLM and how it applies to the UK is different. But we do have real issues. I mean, opportunities, the access to the top echelons of society, they're real issues that we have to deal with.
Do you think it is more about class than in some ways in Britain? Because you must have seen people at your grammar school who you knew were really clever and didn't actually achieve in the same way. That sort of huge lost opportunities.
I've seen a lot of people that you might call up middle and upper class not achieve either. So I don't think it's as simple as that. I think this achievement is a real combination of aspiration. Someone letting you know that there's a big world out there and you can do whatever you want. Access to opportunity. Lots of working class kids don't have the access to opportunities, and that's clear, and lots of companies are trying to do things about that. You've got role models. If you've never seen anybody make it, or if you have seen people make it, then that's very helpful. There's all sorts of other things, right? The diet, you know, school meals. You know, young people not have any breakfast before they go to school, right? Free school meals, the quality, exercise. I mean, it's all that combination. Now, you know, when I was growing up, there were, as I've said, there were lots of kids that were brighter than me. Yeah, I was never top of the class. So there has to be some element in there that's different.
So why do you think you made it and they didn't?
I think a combination of self-belief, self-help, and, you know, help from others. So I did believe I could do it for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. I was helped by a lot of people. So, you know, my wife and my tutor at Cambridge and Ellie Kay and the partners at Pomera. And I surrounded myself with really, really good people. I'm quite happy for people to think or be brighter than me. And we have a conversation, make a decision like that. So that's really helpful. On an individual basis, though, as I said, hard work. You know, the harder you work, the luckier you get. I think that is really true. More opportunities come your way. People see that. They give you more responsibility. But the human element, right, so empathy. When I was at Pomera for 27 years, and when I was interviewed there, I was interviewed by about five or six people. This is 1987, right? So five or six people. And I got the job, and I thought it was great. Really, must be absolutely super bright. About 6 months later, I asked the partner, why did they give me the job? And they said that when you came out of the elevator, you were the only person to look the receptionist and the secretary in the eye and say, good morning, how are you? She came back straight into his office and said, you've got to hire him.
Really? So it's courtesy?
Yeah. Well, it's just empathy, isn't it? It's manners, yeah. Empathy. I mean, I always say that people like to work with people they like. Right? Mm. It's very important.
And you've made a lot of money, but you've also given a lot of money away. Why is that, do you think? Do you feel a necessity to, or is it guilt, or is it just a sense of giving back?
So we live here. We live in this country. We think this country is a really good place to be. I'm proud to be British. But we have some issues, right, in this country. And one of we started a foundation 15 years ago now, and the focus of that foundation is really to give opportunities to young people that wouldn't otherwise have them. Because I think if you look at that talent and you can nurture that talent and give people the opportunities and they grasp them, that's going to make this country a better place. So that's what we do. We do that in, you know, education, bursaries, we apprenticeships. We have got people in performing arts, schools, whatever it is, it's all about giving young people a fair crack of the whip.
So it's not about sort of gap between rich and poor, it's about giving everyone the chance to make it.
I think there are two important things there. So education is so important, right? Especially in this globalised world. You know, in some of the Asian countries, Bangladesh, they're getting paid by the minute, right? So we're not going to be able to compete on that basis. We're in the knowledge economy. So that means our people have got to have knowledge. They've got to have a good education. So that access to education is so important. But then, once you've got it, you've got to have access to the opportunities. So, and that's one of the issues, right? That everyone recruits in their own image. You're looking in the same place all the time. So broadening out that access and combining it with education will make a difference.
Do you have a sense at all that a sort of disaster can also be an opportunity, that in a way a small, nimble company now can succeed when the larger corporations are perhaps too old-fashioned?
Yeah, every industry, every single industry is being disrupted, right? And that's because you've got the transparency of the internet and you have this global market. So you literally can access hundreds of millions of customers from your desk if you have the right idea and the right energy. Right, and so that means it's in the old days. That's not my grandma. In the old days, it was big versus small. Right? You're a big company, create barriers to entry. Now it's fast versus slow, and the fast are definitely going to win. So if you're not in touch with your customers, somebody else will be. They'll disrupt you, and you're seeing it everywhere.
You're seeing the high street.
You're seeing it everywhere. Mm. No. the real visible aspect of that is the high street, but you're seeing it absolutely every single business.
So for you, what do you think is the secret of your success? Do you think it's sort of dedication or luck or character, resilience? What do you think it is?
You know, all, a combination of all those. So we've, I think hard work is just crucially important. Being able to interact with lots of different people from all different backgrounds, create a team. Pamira was a team of partners. It wasn't just one person, it wasn't just me. It was lots of us. And that ability to forge that team together, to understand where everyone wants to go and create that culture and that environment, it's very, in my experience, that's really made a difference for me. But you have to get yourself into the right place. You have to have the self-belief. Right? You have to believe you can do it, and apply yourself to get there, and then take the opportunities when they present themselves.
And what advice would you have given to yourself at the age of 10 now?
Think big. So having gone from Leicester to London to Boston to New York, then all around the world, you just realise what can be achieved.
Would you ever have dreamed when you were 10 that would happen?
No, and that's what I say to a lot of young people. Mm. Look, it's step by step. And when they, looking at me, a lot of them will think, well, that's just completely unachievable. But, I was like them. Right? And so it really is step by step. But eventually, as you said, what would I give my 10-year-old self? What advice would I give you? You'd say, look back and say, okay, look, really is no limit to what you can achieve. I'd also say, keep your eye on the prize, right? Because sometimes it's quite difficult. It's very difficult, and you have to get through that. And so, if you've got a goal, just and you want to get there, just keep thinking about that.
What's the hardest thing, do you think, been for you?
In hindsight, the hardest aspect of my career was probably getting from Thurnby Lodge probably into the city. That time period. As I've said, there's no safety nets, right? It's going to be no second chances. So, looking back, there were a few risks. But not being a lawyer, that was quite hard. It was a good call, but it was quite hard at the time.
And has it made you more empathetic, do you think, coming from the background that you did, that you understand where other people in the room are coming from?
I used to go to school on the bus with the factory workers and the receptionists and everybody. So I know what they're like, where they come from, and so hopefully it enables you to identify with all sorts of people. So from captains of industry to the people that you might not know are there, but they're just making a huge contribution to the business and or the organisation, whatever it is. So, and they've all got their own aspirations, and they've all got their own lives, and therefore treating everybody that you meet with respect, I think, is really important, right? I mean, okay, you've got your own agenda and you want to do something, but you'd be surprised at how important everybody is to success. So I can understand where other people are coming from and try and get on with them.
So do you think there is a sense in which adversity in childhood can be an advantage in your later life?
Certainly gives you determination, can do. It gives you that work ethic. Okay, so I've been in this situation. I don't really want to be there anymore. How am I going to get out of it? And it certainly, in my mind, that don't rest on your laurels. I'm not going back there. That gives you that, certainly gave me that drive to get to where I've got to.
But do you worry then about your own children that they haven't got the same sort of drive, or they've had it too easy, or you've made their life too simple for them, or not?
I hope they've been instilled with the right sort of values and they've got their own lives, and that's what I think what you can do for your children, right? So right education, and you hope they make success of their lives. They're good people. I'm very optimistic about them.
Damian Buffini, thank you very, very much for talking to us.
Pleasure.
listening to Past Imperfect with me, Rachel Sylvester, Alice Thompson, and our guest, Damon Buffini.
This is a Wireless Studios production for Times Radio, produced by Ben Mitchell.
To listen back to our previous guests and make sure you never miss an episode, do subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts and the Times Radio app.
Until next time, thanks for listening.
If you've been affected by any of the issues raised in this episode or others in this series, please go to our podcast page or website, where there are links to charities and organisations who are there to help.
Tired of ads intruding into your favourite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.